Yeah. What have you got?
Got two victims in Brentwood.
Brentwood? Nobody gets killed in Brentwood.
All right.
You're going to say this case is all about race?
Yes, because it is.
Do you think he did it?
She was terrified of him.
I'm not a public personality. I don't know how to do this.
He's my friend. I don't turn my back on people.
You're turning your back on Nicole.
Who the hell signs a suicide note with a happy face?
I ain't trying to be respectful. I'm trying to win.
You want to make this a black thing? Well, I'm not black. I'm OG.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. My name is Bina 007, and today I am joined by Julia.
Yes, I'm also no true lady on the forums, when I choose to go to the forums, which I really should do more often. But what are we going to be talking about today, Bina?
We're talking about, rather randomly, the murder of poor Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman, allegedly by O.J. Simpson. I guess we both believe it was by O.J. Simpson. On June 12th, 1994, the subsequent trial, acquittal, and all the stuff around that. I mean, I guess from this is a bit of a random podcast in terms of timing. It's not the anniversary of the murders. I've been watching, rewatching actually, The People versus OJ, watched the recent OJ Made in America. And it's just, I don't know. It's something that's been really playing on my mind recently for no real reason. And I'm very excited to talk about it with you and exorcise this craziness. But why don't you tell us what it was like for you? Let's get into this by means of the verdict that shocked the world and what your reaction to it was.
So I was in middle school when this happened. It would have been, I want to say, seventh grade. But anyway, middle school. And I remember it was the afternoon and we all knew that the verdict was coming down that day. And I'm sitting in class and suddenly another teacher just opens the door, pops his head in. We all look. And it wasn't like we were expecting him to deliver the verdict. It was like, why is this other teacher randomly coming in? And he just said, not guilty. And the entire classroom went, what? And we were in a little bit of a hubbub for a minute, but then the, because apparently this teacher was going around just telling everyone, because this is before everyone had cell phones, you know, cell phones were still those bricks, essentially, that you see sometimes on TV.
So do you mind if I ask, because obviously race is such a big part of this case, was your school basically pretty white?
I was going to mention that next. It was a class full of white kids in a school full of white kids in a district full of white people. And now, even now, several decades on, it's still not very diverse. A little tiny bit more, but it is still, probably like I saw like 95% white. So this class full of white, WASP, Anglo-Saxon Protestant descendant kids, middle class, suburban, our reaction was of disbelief, whereas when I got home that night and saw on the news, there were classrooms of, in cities full of black children cheering the verdict. And I just remember that this moment of just such shock and confusion of how could they be happy about, how could anyone be happy about this?
So I find this fascinating. So as a teenager or younger, I guess, a young teenager watching this unfold over television for months during the trial, had it not sort of entered your consciousness that the black part of America was on his side, like it was shocking to you that they would be happy at the verdict? Was this the point that the race issue really came to its fore, I guess?
Well, I mean, for me, but this wasn't really discussed. I mean, it was mentioned, but the environment I was in that was so predominantly white, we had all made up our minds. And I think it's actually good to note right now that I grew up in Western New York, very close to Buffalo, New York, where OJ had his glory days and became a celebrity playing for the Buffalo Bills. And there was a lot, like the local connection, people felt very strongly. And I felt like it was like this bulwark, wall put up of, we had decided what was happening and that was it. And there was no real discussion, it was just sort of watching the news in dismay every night because you couldn't get away from it. This is when the internet was still just percolating. And really it was TV, magazines, and talking amongst yourselves face to face. And that's what we had.
And actually, one of the points that OJ Made in America makes very strongly is that this was just at the start of when you got the rolling 24 news channels.
Yes.
And that massively amplified how the case was covered. Obviously, the judge decided to let cameras in, but that they needed material. And so much mm-hmm. about the worst excesses of those channels, even today, comes from that formative experience of covering that trial.
Oh, yeah. And another part is, in my household, we didn't have cable. And so I think to an extent I missed out on a lot of that firsthand coverage, whereas it was just the nightly news and what they replayed from that day. And it was truly mentioned every day for that whole span of time, however long it was, year and a half.
Yeah.
It was inescapable.
It's kind of strange to me because I was a sort of teenager as well, just before going to university, because I'm a little bit older than you. And it was massive news here. And I think that also plays into the fact that we have a very strong tabloid journalism culture. So
yes,
know, the big tabloid papers have always been probably more scabrous and salacious than the average anywhere else in the world.
Oh, you know, anytime I see a tabloid headline from the UK, it's always shocking to me. Like, what? It's just the viciousness is something beyond my experience here in the US.
It's always amazing to me, partly because we have very strong libel and slander laws here, but mm-hmm. yet somehow they managed to tread the fine line. So it was huge news. And I remember being very, so for people who don't know me from the forums, I should explain that I'm an Asian African ethnic mix, but one who went to a very sort of WASPy style private school. So I don't know how I would have identified at that age, but not necessarily as being black or white, somewhere in the middle. But it was very interesting to me seeing the O.J. Simpson trial on the back of the Rodney King riots, and just feeling that there was this way in which race played out in America that felt very weird and alien to me in Britain. And I'm not saying that there's no racism in Britain or race isn't like a political issue, but it's just not to that level. It doesn't divide people in that same way, thank goodness. And so not being shocked by the verdict because the colour of the jury, crudely put. And actually, as a teenager, I hadn't followed the ins and outs of the prosecution, whereas now I kind of believe they were right not to convict, but probably they did it for different reasons than I would have done it. But it was amazing. And then just seeing the rioting afterwards was just appalling. And as this kind of, you know, like village bound British teenager, it just added to all those cliches and prejudices one would have had of LA at that time. You know, Rodney King, it was a time when like gangster rap was really big and West Coast rap. So I just had this vision of like the West Coast of America as a sort of hugely violent, racially divided place.
Well, the early 90s were an interesting time because it was the big before this urban renaissance happened in places like New York City, where they really got quote unquote cleaned up after being really unpleasant for the 70s and 80s. And, you know, LA definitely had that reputation as well as just being a very unpleasant place. The thing is, LA, it's a giant I lived in California for 7 years and visited LA a couple times. And, It's just this big sprawling, like I hesitate even to call it a city because the urban core, the downtown, is so small compared to what you're used to in other cities, even in say San Francisco, the other major city in California. And it's just sprawling suburb, which was by design.
And it makes it feel very heartless. I mean, I spent a lot of time in LA. The downtown is truly tiny. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's going through a gentrification now. You have like arts district and stuff, but it's still pretty sketchy in places. And yeah.
I mean, I think it would be okay. Like if I had to live in LA for work or what have you, I think it would be fine. I mean, it feels like everyone I know who's in LA lives in like Los Feliz, which I'm sure is fine. But to go back to wrap around to sort of the race issue, I mean, obviously in America, because we used to enslave a whole group of people and then we had a war to free them and we haven't really ever resolved it completely and just found other ways to be really awful to the descendants of those freed slaves. It's just this ongoing conversation, stop-start conversation that never really goes well. And I mean, like, again, speaking where I was, you know, where I grew up, where I was living at the time of the whole O.J. Simpson crime and trial, predominantly white, and because of the proximity to Buffalo Bills, we had just made our minds up. it was a very stark divide about black versus white. And I guess I just, you know, I was 13 when all this happened, 12, 13 years old. So I really didn't, I really didn't think about it deeply. And also living in a very white area, you don't, you know, again, as we mentioned, this is before the internet really took over. I wasn't exposed to any other points of view.
Yeah, and
I just
problem,
wasn't.
And I think I think the lack of the internet does, it hinders research in a certain extent, doesn't it? I remember much later getting interested in more true crime stuff and going and finding those old Vanity Fair columns by Dominic Dunn covering
Were fantastic.
Which were amazing, and they're all available online, and really, and he did the Menendez trial as well. And
well, I mean, you know that his own daughter, who was a aspiring actress, murdered in her driveway by a vengeful ex-boyfriend.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, her name was Dominique after him, Dominic. Dominic Dunn, that's someone, he was a very complicated man. Problematic in some ways by our current standards, but an amazing writer, an amazing crime writer. So yes, as Bina just said, you should look up the archives of his work for Vanity Fair if you have any interest in true crime or just modern American writing.
Absolutely. What I find fascinating is that, you know, I started reading those in maybe my 20s, and now, you know, I'm just turned 40, and we've just had this amazing OJ Made in America that won an Oscar, which I kind of find weird as a feature documentary because it was really a TV miniseries that lasted 8 hours or something, but magisterial, and it gives so much context. And I feel that as time goes on and I mature and get more nuanced on my views on race, you get so much more out of this case, because I think it really is emblematic of a certain kind of race struggle. And although I utterly condemn obviously what happened to those poor people and what OJ I believe did, I do have not sympathy for him for committing the murders, because I think he was protected by the system and he was a horrible wife abuser. But I find, this is going to sound really weird, I can empathize with the idea of a person who grew up and came to fame in a much less enlightened time, when if you were successful, what you did was you identified as white and cancelled out your blackness. Because I think that's what I did when I was, like, that's what we did. The first, second generation of immigrants of, you know, from East Africa to England. We became very successful and we assimilated. And if you look at, it's really fascinating in OJ Made in America, where he gets huge success as a football player. He has crossover success to the mainstream. He's advertising Hertz rental cars to a white audience. He was the first advertising superstar icon who could advertise cross-race. And whenever you watch interviews with him, he doesn't identify as black. Like, people say to him, don't you feel like proud to be the first black man to do this? He says, you know what, I never think of race, it doesn't affect me. He wants to create a picture of himself as above racial divisiveness rather than as a champion of the black man.
And that's very interesting and very telling, isn't it?
Yeah, and I have some sympathy with that, because I think in the 70s and 80s, if you wanted to assimilate, that's kind of what you did. You picked kind of white names, you went to whiter schools, you didn't emphasize your ethnicity, you just wanted to blend in and get ahead. You didn't want to cause a fuss, you know? And I think there's telling parallels also to what's happening with sexual activism right now and gender balance. Like, now, I feel the current generation, like the millennials, are much more willing to be forceful and demand their rights. Whereas the Gen Yers were much more conditioned to just be quiet and you'll get ahead kind of thing. It's a totally different attitude. But I kind of sympathize with it. He just didn't identify as black, and he hung out with white cops and rich white people in Brentwood, and he married a white woman. But then when he got in trouble, he used the race card. So there's the irony, right?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that O.J. Simpson is not a good person.
Oh no!
And definitely just working a whole the situation, whatever situation he was in, to his advantage. I have here a quote from People magazine from 1975, calling Simpson the first black athlete to become a bona fide, lovable media superstar, which is like, it sounds very racist, you know, looking at it back. But I mean, that's what he was. He was everywhere. I mean, when the murders happened, I had obviously heard the name O.J. Simpson, but his career with the Buffalo Bills was long over by the time I was coming up as a young Bills fan. During the Buffalo Bills' infamous Super Bowl runs back in the 90s, where they went like 4 years in a row, but they never won. But I remember the adults around me, my parents, aunts, and uncles, being shocked, because O.J. Simpson was of their generation. And my dad's family is from Buffalo. One of my aunts, in her younger days, was quite a sort of a party animal, and she ran in some of these same circles of, you know, where OJ and his friends were. And I remember during the trial, during that whole crazy year, her saying, you know, back in the day, he did not have a good reputation.
No, because it's a pattern, right? It doesn't come out of nowhere, this behavior.
Right, right. I mean, you know, he was never known as being nice to women, basically.
Yeah. And I don't think, well, I don't know. I think it's really fascinating that for those of us in Britain of my age, like, we didn't even know really he was an American football player. To us, he was the guy from the Airplane movies.
Right.
And commercials. Like, the fact that he was this famous athlete was, like, very much in the dim and distant past. But I think it is, I think he must have been quite intelligent, or is quite intelligent, in the sense that to parlay that football fame and money into something more lasting, I think, was interesting. Yeah. Like, business wise.
Yeah, he's kind of was one of the first people to do it. I think it feels like a more normal path, career path now, where you get these crossover celebrities like John Cena, who started in wrestling, and he's just sort of, you know, or the Rock, Dwayne the Rock Johnson. I think those are good examples.
Yeah, but in some ways they stand on the shoulders of OJ, right? I mean, OJ was a pioneer, mm-hmm. in some respects as a black athlete to do that. And mm-hmm. I would love to know, and I would love to get your thoughts. Obviously, he marries a black woman, has children from his first marriage, mm-hmm. but then he trades, well, I don't want to sound racist. I think in his perception, he would feel that he traded up to Nicole Brown Simpson. Like, he became white, he became more acceptable, more establishment, and lives in Brentwood.
I would sort of agree with that, in that it's the way he saw things, for sure. And, you know, Nicole was the ultimate blonde, you know, not unlike Marilyn Monroe. Yes, I know she wasn't a natural blonde. It's a concept that she was the ultimate American bombshell for their time, for the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, I mean, stunningly beautiful woman. Mm-hmm. When you see footage of her, looks very charismatic, looks very much in love with him, actually. I think, I'm sure it didn't hurt that he was sort of very super rich, but you actually get the impression that she wasn't a gold digger at all, that she just genuinely, when you read her diaries and her letters, which you can do now, that she really wanted the marriage to work, and she really wanted to be a good wife to him. And when he was beating her, she would kind of, in the most awful way, internalize it and be like, how can I be a better wife? You know, I think she really loved him.
Well, I think part of it is that he got her young. She was very young when they got together, still married to his first wife. And really, you know, when this is something that abusers do, you know, they find someone younger than them who is impressionable, who is going to sort of imprint on them as a parental figure, you know, as opposed to a romantic life partner. And you can really make them do whatever you want after that. And also, you know, someone younger, you can make them overlook things like, hey, I'm still married with a couple kids.
So I'm just getting the ages up. She was born in 1959 and he was born in 1947. So mm-hmm. yeah, there's a good 12-year age gap. And when they met, let's just have a look.
Yeah, I mean, age gaps in and of themselves, not necessarily a bad thing. Just, you know, just
exercise caution. She met him when she was just 18 years old as a waitress, and it's not so much the age. And there was this really interesting bit on a recent Vogue where I think it was Mary Nymerius saying, like, 10-year age gap, 25 to 15, be wary. And actually, be wary if you're 15, right? But I think it's more the power thing, that she was an 18-year-old, mm-hmm. stunningly beautiful, but just a waitress. And he would have been a 30-year-old, you know, famous athlete, super rich. I mean, there's a huge power imbalance there, right? And that's the thing that makes you wary, where all the power lies right on one side of the relationship. That's the really troubling part. And oh my goodness, I think it's as with all of these things, right? You have to keep the victims at the forefront and not make this the OJ cast. I mean, this is ultimately about Nicole and Ron losing their lives. But anyway, so I'm curious
and
as to your
two children losing their mother too. Sorry.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And what I'm curious to know your view on is, and I've been puzzling over this, when he was living this Brentwood life with Nicole that looks very happy and they've got the two gorgeous children, he starts, you know, playing golf at this very Tony golf club, and he starts hanging out with the police because, you know, he will invite them to the club to play golf there. He will, you know, pay for their drinks. He definitely cultivates the cops. And I'm just wondering if you believe that was just another example of him, like, he liked to be in the white establishment, right? And I think that made him feel better about himself and distance himself from his poor black background. I wonder if you think that was deliberate because he knew he was a wife beater. He knew his wife was ringing up the cops and reporting him. And it was deliberate that he wanted the cops to be cozy and on his side. How conscious was he?
It could be a little bit of both, to be honest. You know, I really don't know much about, I mean, like, I don't want to speculate too much about what's going on in his head, except to say, yeah, probably that sounds about right. Because I mean, like, again, he's not a good person, and whatever he decided to do would have been to just his advantage at any given moment. So could have been either of those things or both.
Certainly came in handy anyway.
Yeah, I mean, he had gone on to have this, you know, Hollywood LA life, and he had really reached this pinnacle of stardom, of celebrity, that was pretty much, he was sort of the first to do it. And I mean, he was a very, very handsome man back in the day. You just have to look at the photos. Very good looking.
Stunningly
very
good looking. I mean, they were a stunning couple. They were equally good looking. Absolutely.
Yeah, great smile. You know, I mean, and he was just, he seemed like a celebrity who didn't take himself too seriously. He seemed like a really good-natured person. And the wheels really came off of that, obviously, but he had cultivated a persona that was publicly, you really couldn't mess with it. But I mean, just like, you know, talking about the current, you know, sex abuse scandals that are, you know, rocking the entertainment industry, people knew, they just didn't say anything because you didn't say anything. You just didn't.
Well, I mean, this is something that continues to this day, is all the Harvey Weinstein and all the sexual harassment and rape stuff that's coming out in our shows. So that the tragedy of this marriage is that he pleaded no contest to spousal abuse in 1989.
Yeah, as part of their whole divorce. Or leading up to it, rather.
Absolutely. The police had tapes of her calling in 911 calls when he was beating her up. She had placed a Polaroid of herself with a huge bruising to her face in a safety deposit box.
I remember she
had told her her family, like, she was in fear of her life and in fear of the fact that he might kill her. And I think that even after they divorced, which was let's have a look, 1992 she filed for divorce, 1993 they made an attempt at reconciliation. But basically, it's kind of interesting to me because I don't know, do you listen to a podcast called Real Crime Podcast?
I've heard of it, but I don't listen to it.
Yeah. So it's done by a guy who is ex-FBI behavioral psychologist and advises many TV shows, and by a lady who's ex-Scotland Yard in the UK, ex-FBI, also behavioral psychologist, but specializes in coercive control, spousal abuse and domestic violence. And something that she says very strongly is that when you're in an abusive relationship, the most dangerous time is when you're saying that you're going to go.
Right.
And I think there's something very interesting about the timeline here, because obviously they divorced already. So to a certain extent, she'd gone right.
Right. But they couldn't untangle and become a divorced couple co-parenting. They never accomplished that.
This is exactly it, right? This is
there's a great quote I want to interject here from a Vanity Fair article, not by Dominic Dunn, by Sheila Weller, about their relationship. This is from an article from a couple years ago, 2014, looking back at the crime. They were a dramatic, fractious, mutually obsessed couple before they married, after they married, after they divorced in 1992, and after they reconciled. There you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
And two people obsessed with each other who hated each other, I guess.
Yeah, actually, there's a really interesting book by a private investigator that I read, which alleges that O.J. Simpson's eldest son by his first marriage also has sort of been treated for psychiatric problems and has a very obsessive personality, and that he had a very close relationship with Nicole and couldn't cope with being stood up by her. And she apparently, on the night of the murders, she was meant to eat at his restaurant and he was going to sort of prepare the special meal. and at the last minute they went to a different restaurant, and that he murdered her in a revenge attack, and that OJ covered it up, and that's where the DNA is the same. Anyway, I'm going to cut that bit out.
Okay.
But that's
all right.
It's crackpot. I'll send you the link. It's an ebook. Like, it's really interesting. Okay. It makes a lot of sense when you're reading it, and then when you put it down, you're like, no, this didn't happen.
Well, it's like every single Jack the Ripper suspect book I read, I'm nodding along like, yes, this makes sense. And then I stop and I go back, you know, to casebook.org or something. And I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah, this makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, the point is that he was abusive through the marriage. And I think there was definitely coercive control there, because even when she was dating after the marriage, I think there was a certain sort of deference or fear of him perceiving her to have left him. But there is an interesting, and I think it's fair to say without being an expert that there's some disagreement on this. If you're physically abusive to a partner, does that mean you're more or less likely to kill them? In other words, is the category of a rage murder, you know, qualitatively different? It's not a crime of escalation from spousal abuse. And the people on True Crime Podcast definitely believe that it was a crime of escalation. But I know that some people think very strongly that you shouldn't confuse the two, and just because someone was domestically violent doesn't mean necessarily that they would kill someone, especially in such an egregiously violent way as occurred. Don't know if you have views on that.
I mean, not really. I mean, I believe that he did do it, but who can say what makes a person go and do such a thing? I think that the fact that they did have this history of physical violence and mutual obsession, if you will, definitely, you know, like, okay, it got worse over time. I just think the timing is interesting. They were divorced. They'd been divorced for a couple of years. What was he doing there? What set him off? What made him finally do it? That's what I sort of find strange. I guess this whole idea that neither of them could really move on.
Particular night, and why what's strange to me is that it's not like, what would have been threatening to him? Like, if she had found a serious new partner who was maybe as wealthy as him, I mean, there were obviously allegations at the time that she was having an affair earlier with Marcus Allen, like someone like that who he would see as a younger version of himself, maybe better looking, better at football, richer. Maybe that would have been someone to bring out a jealous sort of, you know, terrifying rage. But that night, they'd had a family dinner to celebrate. I think the daughter or one of the kids had been in a concert, and they'd gone out for a dinner, and that's when Ron Goldman came to deliver the glasses she'd left at the restaurant. But was it really a date, because she had all the candles out? Who knows? But the poor Ron Goldman, talk about wrong time, wrong place. It's hard to see Ron Goldman as being like a sexual threat to OJ Simpson. But then, you know, who knows what was going on in OJ Simpson's mind? But it is very weird to me that it just feels like something must have happened, whether a phone call or a conversation, that made him feel particularly angered or insecure or whatever it was.
And that it was time to act. Because, I mean, there was a knife, and this happened. The thing is, the home she used to live in is no longer there. This is a very California thing. The home was leveled and I think subdivided into a couple different properties. And, you know, where it used to be, it's now completely different. You know, like, you can drive by, but like, it's that the crime scene is not there anymore.
Interesting. Is the Rockingham house where OJ lived still there?
I do not know. I only know for sure because I watched a video about it, that the home where she was killed, her home, is no longer there.
Gosh. Okay. And I've read everything about this murder. If anyone listening has a good theory as to why specifically on this night he does it, if you think he does it, I think most of us do, then please let me know, because it really puzzles me.
Yeah, that is something that puzzles me as well. I mean, I can dig deeper into that because now I'm really wondering.
I can see a generic motive, which is sexual jealousy. I just can't see a specific trigger.
Well, I mean, okay, so it was, you know, late in the evening on a June night.
June 13th, 1994, 12:10 a.m. they're found. Well, so yes. The night of June 12th, I guess. Well, 10, 11 at night.
Yeah, I guess we'll just go and get into the crime here now. Her dog was found very, it was around 10 o'clock in the evening, a little after 10. A couple neighbors reported hearing the very distressed barking of a dog. And then another neighbor was out, I think, doing his end of the night, you know, whatever it was, taking out the trash or walking his dog or whatever it was. And he found Nicole's dog dragging its leash and very upset and with its paws covered in blood. And he quickly, you know, he recognized the dog as his neighbor's dog. He looked to see if the dog was injured. and it wasn't. And he took the dog into his house where it just got even more agitated. Then, because he knew who the dog belonged to, went back, went up the front walkway, found the bodies. So, oh God, if dogs could talk. Because chances are that dog saw everything. Like, I'm imagining a scenario where she was taking the dog out for like the end of the night, you know, pee break, quick walk around the block or whatever that, you know, people do when they have dogs. And she met up with Ron to get her, because it was her mom's glasses that had been left at the restaurant.
Yes. Yeah.
And went out to grab those, and then something awful happened there in that, because if you've seen the pictures of the crime scene, it was this walkway up to the front of the house, but it was very densely landscaped.
Absolutely. Very hard to see from the road. Very, very dark and secluded and claustrophobic. In fact, we should insert a warning here, as we often do. If you haven't yet seen the crime scene photos and you're tempted to look them up because you're listening to this, I would urge definite caution, because you can find pretty much everything, which is of itself pretty horrific.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a crime of real rage and violence. Nicole, multiple stab wounds. She's got defense. The most disturbing, actually, for both of them, both Ron and Nicole, is seeing the hands put up in defense and the stab wounds as they try to defend themselves. They were definitely alive from most of this pain and horror and frenzy. You know, her neck is basically almost severed from her head.
Exactly. She was almost beheaded. Awful.
There's such rage here. And yeah, exercise caution, because there are some things you don't unsee. And yeah, this is one of them, I'm afraid.
I've stumbled upon the Columbine school shooting crime scene photos by accident. So, you know, yeah, it was pretty much all the blood that could be in a person was put out onto those front steps. We'll put it that way. Awful, awful, awful.
Yeah, and actually what impresses you with that, and we're not criminologists, right, so we shouldn't say something, but it's a crime of power and rage and frenzy with significant blood loss. And yes, that means that one would expect to see blood transferred, and I guess that's significant for later. But also because it is a sort of slightly claustrophobic and weird entrance to the house, something that does feel like you'd have to know what you were doing, because it's not a normal sort of very open entrance, etc.
Yeah, it was almost like a tunnel of greenery, if you will. Yeah, and I mean, there are celebrities that they live in normal neighborhoods, so to speak, but they want their privacy. People in general just want their privacy. So seeing this, I understand why she would have had the front of the house set up that way, but it's just so sinister. And someone, you know, like, I remember there was the theory that it had somehow been a gangland killing or something. No, they do it fast, in and out. They don't, that's not what gets done.
Yeah, the idea that this was mafia, or there was a story put around at some point that Nicole and Ferris, you know, the infamous morally, what was it? That they were sort of drug addicts and they owed drug money and this was a drug killing. I mean, like, nothing is more ludicrous. This is a very personal, very aggressive, very vindictive murder. There is nothing professional and efficient about this whatsoever. And even an untrained amateur like myself can tell that. Like, the concept this was a professional hit is just simply absurd.
Right. I mean, I kind of feel like someone went there with the intent to do something and lost complete control over themselves, and yeah, rage, just pure rage.
So do you think he went there to threaten her or to kill her? Well,
again, yeah, we have to go back to why that night, why then, you know, I mean, I guess that's where these alternative theories come from. Why that night? Why did he go there?
Mm. Yeah.
So I think that the answer to that is the reason why it happened the night it did.
Yeah, absolutely fascinated. In fact, I'd love to do some research and do maybe a follow up on this, because I find that whole trigger to be fascinating. At any rate, so.
Well, I was going to say we could further muddy the waters with speculation about what we now know, what's known as CET, basically the, you know, long term progressive brain damage that athletes in contact sports have been found to get, especially in football. And that can lead to massive personality changes. Basically, young people, you know, and people who are, say, in their 30s, 40s, 50s, suddenly coming down with dementia-like symptoms and rages.
Huh. You know,
so
okay.
we kind of have to throw that into the mix too, because it's something we now know. And he was a football player. And of course, not every. There was some study that was done recently where former professional football players had donated their brains to a study. And it was, they did 101, or their families had, and they looked at 101 brains, and 100 of them had signs of this specific kind of brain damage. So obviously it doesn't happen to everyone who plays contact sports, but it probably happens to a lot more than we'd like to think.
Gosh.
So did I just completely throw a huge wrench in your whole line of thinking?
No, but I mean, not a huge wrench, because I think maybe it's a horrible combination. I mean, maybe this was mm-hmm. someone who had the kind of personality and behavioral dynamics that are going to lead him to be an abusive spouse. And maybe the combination of that and the sort of the brain damage from football made... So you're already a violent personality, and then you have something that makes your ability to stop being triggered into something even worse go. I mean, that could just be a horrible cocktail.
Sure.
Right there. Yeah. Of course, not wanting to sound like an apologist, but it's a fascinating theory to consider.
Yeah. That was what stopped him from being able to, you know, I mean, like, let's say a scenario that he just happened to go to the house for some other reason and happened to see her talking to this attractive young man. And who, you know, Ron Goldman, who was, you know, an acquaintance of hers and was going to return these glasses that have been left, and completely benign.
Mm.
But, you know, if this was someone who was already in an impaired, you know, mental state because of this long-term brain damage. When I say long-term, I mean they were just taking hits consistently over the course of their career. And maybe it wasn't the same as being in some horrific car accident. It was just these like little jostlings every week, and it adds up. So that's what I mean there. But, he may have gone to the house for another reason, and just, it may have been the worst timing in the history of anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. So anyway, back to the night of the crime. We can stop saying alleged, right? OJ then gets into his Ford Broncos, trailing blood, goes back to Rockingham, and then catches a flight to Chicago.
Yeah, that was weird. And where are the kids for all this?
The kids are in the house where Nicole's murdered.
Oh my God, that's right.
That's what I mean. There's real... it's a real mental breakdown that to do that thing and to overlook the fact or disregard the fact that your kids are sleeping in that house. Mm-hmm. As much as you hate this woman, the love for your kids, I mean, oh, anyway. But yeah, so he takes a flight to Chicago, and this is now notorious because he had a golf bag. And the idea is that he could have had evidence from the murder somehow put it in a dustbin somewhere at the airport or in Chicago. There is a bag that he then gives to Robert Kardashian, his best friend and lawyer, although he wasn't really a criminal lawyer, but was kept on the staff. And let's discuss his attitudes to the murder as we go through. But
yeah,
I feel that the trip to Chicago for O.J. Simpson is a bit like Lee Harvey Oswald's week in Mexico for JFK assassination people, because everything mysterious that you can't explain, you can put on that trip in terms of evidence.
I mean, was it ever determined, or what was his supposed reasoning for going to Chicago immediately
Hertz.
This had been planned?
I think it was a corporate sponsor, so he was fulfilling a corporate obligation. Yeah, so I mean, it wasn't like he didn't go on a humbug, right? So there was a reason for him to have gone.
So it wasn't like he was fleeing the scene.
No, but it's convenient, right? And I think if you think it was premeditated, then I think you can think that it's significant that he did it on a day when he knew.
I think if it was premeditated, another person wouldn't have been killed, and it wouldn't have been happened in that way. I think it was, you know, the worst timing in the world that he went there for some other reason, probably already angry about some perceived slight or what have you. And it just happened.
Mm.
And he went back to his original plans for the rest of the week or whatever.
But anyway, so the detectives go to his house that morning. One of them is the now notorious Mark Furman. He's mm-hmm. not there to tell him that his wife has died. They interview Kato Kaelin. That's when they find the second bloody glove. That's when they find the blood on the Ford Bronco. You know, this is when a lot of the stuff that is then going to get put under the microscope, literally and legally, during the trial, as to the evidence gathering techniques, the credibility, the ethics of the policeman doing the evidence collecting, is going to come to light in this sort of crucial next 12 hours. It's also when Ron Shipp, who was a black LAPD policeman, close friend of OJ Simpson, Simpson joked to him that to be honest, Ship, I've had some dreams about killing her.
Yeah, I read that. And it's just like, come on, guy.
And Ron Ship was really interesting because when the whole thing, when the trial became about race, he was the guy, the one black witness who was willing to testify for the prosecution and say, look, I know he beat her up. I know he had dreams of killing her, and was very much sort of made to be a pariah in his own community. But even now, when you watch him on documentaries such as O.J. Made in America, he just drips with an earnest integrity and actually guilt that he knew that O.J. was violent for so long, didn't realize it was going to get to the point of murder and didn't do anything earlier. So he's a very haunting figure of all the figures that you see. Really tragic, I think.
So. That is really sad. I mean, there's nothing worse than being a spectator to this sort of awful relationship between two people and wishing that you could have done, or, you know, the worst happens and then you're like, why didn't I act? Well, no one ever thinks it's going to get to that point. Not even the person who gets murdered. You don't even, she was saying it. She would go like, if anything ever happens to me, it was OJ. Well, okay, yeah, sure. Okay. But I don't know if she really thought it was ever going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's horrific, isn't it? No one thinks of these sorts of extreme events as being likely. So shall we get into the days after the murders and the amazing way in which the LAPD didn't go arrest him at his house, were allowing him to turn himself in, the slow motion car chase and all that craziness?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I remember when the news of that broke, and then suddenly he basically just went into this gigantic tailspin. I remember the Bronco chase being on TV, and just it went from, well, I mean, like, you couldn't have written something for TV better, could you? It was the most LA thing to ever happen, except for maybe the Menendez murders, but... Or the Black Dahlia, of course.
Indeed. But there was something about that slow motion car chase was just amazing. And
it was just so bizarre.
And it's only in retrospect that I just think it's just astonishing that how is it that he wasn't arrested like any normal guy? How is it that his lawyer was able to negotiate for him no perp walk? It just feels that this entire trial, at least the early, or this entire criminal justice process, was so coloured with the idea that he was a celebrity and therefore had to be handled or deserved to be handled with certain exceptional kid gloves. And that, you know, the justice system was going to bend over backwards to not subject him to a perp walk and to not have cars speed up to his home and arrest him there, but to let him come in under his own terms. A consideration that would not be given to an ordinary suspect. And it just always struck me that, I know celebrity culture is everywhere, but it just seems so Los Angeles, right, that this could happen.
Well, and it really speaks to the level of celebrity he had achieved and to the work he had done to ingratiate himself into the power structures of the place he lived.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, like, I don't think it necessarily shows premeditation, like him saying, okay, I'm going to spend X number of years really, really ingratiating myself with the police and various community organizations and power structures around here, because eventually I know I'm going to kill my wife. I don't see that as being possible to have that line of thinking. It may be that he just had such an inflated sense of self-worth that he thought he could get away with it. And people played into that inflated sense of self-worth because, well, it was LA and he genuinely was a huge celebrity at the time.
But not only was he a celebrity, but even his lawyers were celebrities. And I think that plays into it. When you have a character like Robert Shapiro, so although Bob Kardashian's a lawyer, he obviously isn't a criminal lawyer. And Simpson retains Robert Shapiro, who's incredibly famous. And he seems to be the one who's doing the sort of the broking with the LAPD and with the prosecutors. And what I find astonishing is he does it when you read all the kind of the accounts of this, as if he's a heavyweight, he's a celebrity, and he can dictate terms. And I find that amazing that the DA wasn't more powerful and more strident. But I guess when you're up against someone who earns 10, 20 times what you earn, maybe that plays into it. But it just feels like they were utterly impotent.
Well, like how they just came in and started stage managing this situation of, do you see what just happened? These two people just got completely just destroyed in front of a house in a perfectly normal, quiet neighborhood.
Oh my goodness.
With her kids, you know, I mean, and they were just trying to stage manage it.
It's just appalling. I'm actually looking at the crime, the photos of Nicole and Ron now. Nicole at the bottom of the steps of the house with the foliage, just in a pool of blood, covered in smeared blood. Ron just looks been savaged, and it's
by an animal.
Yeah,
it looks like like what you'd imagine the aftermath of a bear attack, and the way she's just crumpled. You know, it's just
so. It's amazing to me how Gil Garcetti and how Marcia Clark, if you've seen those crime scene photos, and I don't care how famous O.J. Simpson is, if you seriously think he's a suspect, how do you allow him to wake up at his own leisure, bathe at his own leisure, say goodbye to his family at his own leisure, and then maybe by midday turn up to be arrested under his own steam? It's just such a dereliction of duty, and the first of many in the prosecution case.
Mm-hmm.
But it's flabbergasting. It really is. And celebrity protected O.J. for so long and continued to protect him. And Nicole, this poor battered housewife, no matter how beautiful and rich, continued to be let down. Very tragic. It's really continues to be, although it was so many years ago, emblematic of our times, I think.
Yeah, and he got to go to her funeral with their kids as if he had nothing to do with what had happened.
No.
You know, that's insane. Well, that did happen, right? I'm not misremembering that.
No, that genuinely happened. So let's talk about the resolution of this slow motion car chase, and then eventually his peers put into custody. But what I find fascinating about this whole thing is that he left a potential suicide note.
Yes, that's right.
Don't feel sorry for me. I've had a great life. And he's holding a car to his head to AC Cowling's head in this car. Do you feel that suicide note or potential suicide note, do you think that implies that he kind of felt guilty and was, even though he says first, I had nothing to do with Nicole's murder, I think there's extreme kind of like self-protection and delusion going on here. But do you think at some level there's overbearing guilt? Or do you think it's just that rather than anything to do with Nicole's murder, it's just his perfectly curated vision as the wholesome mainstream idol celebrity has been destroyed and he can't cope with that rather than the guilt? Is it the death of Nicole or the death of the image of O.J. Simpson that's causing him to be suicidal?
Okay. Well, I mean, this was all, I have to remember, first of all, because, you know, in memory, it feels like this very rapid fire chain of events. How many days after the murder was that car chase?
Yeah.
Are we looking that up? Because, I mean, you know, it wasn't like his, and it, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say that his public persona wasn't shattered until, say, after that car chase. And I'm wondering if it was the shock, maybe more than the guilt, but the shock of what he had done and the fact that, oh my God, I did, she's gone now. She truly is gone.
Yeah, maybe it was just a reaction to the funeral, just realizing what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just the fact that, you know, the car chase is triggered because he's going to be arrested. And I think there's definitely a sense in which he's always gotten away with it, right? Whenever she's phoned in and said he's been abused, he's always gotten off. He's not ever been arrested. So maybe it's just the shock of mortality. You know, like, I'm not this sort of mortal god who can skate on the surface of everything. But it is amazing, isn't it? The fact that, oh, I don't know. I don't know what he hoped to achieve, but who runs if they're not guilty? To me, that was the point where you have to very seriously. But it's almost comedy, right? Like, what, he's got cash, he's got a change of clothing, he's got a passport, he's got a fake goatee and mustache. Did he really think he was going on the run? I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's just complete and utter panic that we're seeing.
Yeah. But that was, to me, the point at age 17 watching this when race really entered the picture. Not because it had entered the trial yet, but because it was seeing the white Bronco on the news and the kind of the homemade banners on the bridges above with black people from LA saying, you know, run OJ, run, and sort of like,
I remember that.
Him. And that just shocking to me, because the assumption in England was, I'm trying to think if that famous Time front cover had come out yet, but
it was Newsweek where they made it darker.
Yeah,
is that the one you're talking about?
The very subtly racially enhanced picture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, was that Newsweek? A lot of the portrayal of OJ, and this is what OJ Made in America says, is that he was so beloved and so accepted by the white mainstream, but as soon as the murder committed, they turned on him and suddenly he became a black man again, and they were going to enhance and subtly amplify his blackness as danger and threat to this poor white woman who'd been killed. And I think there's something to that. But yeah, those crowds cheering him on, that's when I thought, oh, this is very strange what's going on here.
Oh, wait, it was Time that darkened the photo. Newsweek just showed, had just had the photo as it was taken, whereas Time darkened it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a, and, it's an iconic piece of graphic art, right? I mean, it's beautifully done. But yes, it's very suggestive. You look at that and you think he's guilty. Yeah.
And the headline that, that Time put on that cover was An American Tragedy.
Yeah, so it's already been seen in epic proportions. Epic hero brought low, Greek in its tragic nature, right? And again, that's what OJ Made in America tries to show, hubris nemesis. You know, he rose so high and he had to then be punished in some way. Sometimes I get angry with that kind of stuff. That, I mean, I love OJ Made in America. I love the socio-cultural sort of context it gives to everything and how it uses OJ and emblem, and I tend to use that. But then I think, it's just a guy who abused his wife and killed her, and some poor hapless guy. And sometimes if you make him part of this iconic thing, you can kind of almost, not excuse him, but kind of make grander and more tragic, noble, heroic what was just a nasty, brutal, thuggish, disgusting murder. And he doesn't deserve to be like swept up into this big historical cultural thing, although he is there, right? So what am I saying?
Right. Well, I mean, it was this very sort of zeitgeist sort of moment experience. That was a very, very 90s thing that happened. That's the way I think of it. I mean, for people who were either too young to remember, imagine just a super beloved celebrity and having all this come out about them, having their, you know, estranged or ex-spouse be murdered in this fashion, and, you know, another person who just wasn't at all connected just being swept up in it and killed as well. And then just like, just try to superimpose just, you know, your favorite celebrity today who just seems like a really good person. Yeah, like that's what it was for a lot of people.
I agree. Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's obviously big parallels here also to the Oscar Pistorius Reva Steenkamp murder as well.
Oh, yes. Oh, that was awful, too.
A hero brought low.
And I don't know why. I mean, I think it was just because OJ just had this really great public persona and public presence, and just people liked him. They liked him a lot. And when, you know, I mean, like, there, I remember the old Hertz commercials with him and whatnot. He just had this insane winning smile. Yeah, just the very embodiment of charm.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, and
do you want to get into the way in which this was prosecuted, or do you want to do the defense first?
Well, whatever you want to do next.
I mean, obviously, he pleads not guilty. He hires super expensive dream team. But he's let's get into the prosecution, because I think they're interesting. So it's Gil Cossett, he's DA. It's Marcia Clark who takes the case. When it becomes racially tinged, she brings on board Chris Darden, who I think is one of the few people who's never written a book about it. I think probably does feel quite exploited. He's also the idiot who got OJ to put the glove on, which I think why I find Marcia Clark fascinating and what was really good in The People versus OJ Simpson is they show what happens when you have a woman, a professional woman who had unfortunately bad timing, filed for divorce 3 days before the murder, was under huge stress, single mum. Her husband decided to sell nude photos of her to the press. Her own mum was criticizing her in the press. The amount of pressure that's brought to bear on a woman, her hairstyle, her clothes. Black women apparently think she comes off as cold. You know, I mean, like, a man prosecuting this case would not face this shit. Her personal
life. No one would have cared.
Her ability to be a mother. Everything about her was put under the microscope.
Yeah, it was insane. And I mean, yes, her hair was tragic, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And
I mean, she's
still alive, right? I know a few, like, like Rob Kardashian.
And actually, if you look at interviews with her now, because she's on Made in America as well and many other documentaries, and she looks stunning now. She's actually really pretty, and she sorted her hair out. And she's very articulate, and she's written a book about, you know, stating the prosecution case and talking about why it went wrong. And it's very articulate and worth reading. I mean, I think she did make errors in how she presented the evidence. I think she didn't take the focus group seriously when they said that, you know, brown women don't trust you. She was very arrogant in terms of accepting help. She let Chris Darden run with it. She advised him not to get OJ to try in the glove, but he wanted to, and she let him. That was a mistake. You're the senior prosecutor. So she made mistakes, but I just find her to be, if we're looking for, if we're looking for emblematic tales in this, which is why we're talking about it so many years later, every woman in the workplace, every single mum, divorcee who's had to deal with this shit has sympathy for Marcia Clark, and I certainly do, because I think she just did not deserve the crap she had to go through.
But isn't it interesting how all these people who got involved, I mean, I keep on saying it's just so LA. You know, all these people, they knew how big a deal this was, and just how they became personalities and part of this epic story. You know, and like Mark Furman, like sweet, stupid Cato Kalin, you know, just, and Johnny Cochran, for God's sake, he was a huge personality. And, you know, and how, wasn't it that, because Rob Kardashian, it was for he and his then wife, oh God, I can never remember the mom Kardashian's name. It's Kay.
Chris.
Was either she, like, it was towards the end of her marriage with Rob Kardashian, and right when she was getting together with woman formerly known as Bruce Jenner, now Caitlyn. And they were, she and Bruce, Caitlyn were together, were in the courtroom. Because wasn't it that she was friends with Nicole?
Absolutely. So she was at the funeral. The young kids, so Kim and Courtney, who were the elder ones, would have known OJ Simpson very well. So yeah, they were celebrities. But the problem is that although Robert Kardashian like had a lawyer's license, he hadn't practiced for a while. Mm-hmm. So Robert Shapiro is brought on first. And I think in a way, Johnny Cochran is fascinating because he forces himself onto the case in a way. He's huge in the press talking about the fact that this is going to be a case that's about race, and how can you trust the LAPD when this is just a black man versus white police rather than a rich black man who's really in with the police.
Yeah.
And I think he kind of almost forces his way onto the case. And what The People versus AJ Simpson does very, very well is to show the shifting balance of power between the Dream Team, and that Robert Shapiro got very kind of jealous of the fact that basically it became Johnny Cochran's case, and F. Lee Bailey as well, who was then disbarred, obviously. And who was the guy, who was the lawyer who did all the DNA, who took apart the DNA analysis? Oh, what's his name? Mark, something. Dream Team. Let me just Google it and I can look it up.
Oh, I'd have to, for the defense, I don't remember.
Let me just, give me 1 second.
Was it Alan Dershowitz who...
Oh, here we go. Let's go through them. Okay, so the Dream Team, let's go through them. You've got Robert Shapiro, who's basically the first one. Then you've got Johnny Cochran, who forces himself on this very charismatic, media-savvy black man, activist, campaigner, who sees in the O.J. Simpson case not a means of getting justice for anybody, but for advancing the cause of black rights, which I kind of sympathize with in a way. Robert Kardashian, who isn't really a lawyer. And frankly, if you're a conspiracy theorist, is made to be a lawyer on the case, so he can't be made to testify against OJ about what OJ gave him to keep or any evidence he destroyed. Barry Sheck is the guy, young lawyer at the time, who destroyed the DNA evidence in court. F. Lee Bailey as well, incredibly good but really dodgy character, who was then disbarred. Carl Douglas, who was a younger black lawyer, came with Johnny Cochran, and Peter Neufeld. And then obviously Alan Dershowitz was a consultant, many other consultants. So that was the Dream Team. What's really fascinating is if you look at who has then given statements, it's always like Carl Douglas is very funny when he ever appears on interviews, because he's kind of like, yeah, of course we kind of did this and we played it that way and we punked it that way. Like, he's just like, yeah, this is what we did. And Barry Sheck also gives interviews and says, yeah, I destroyed the evidence in this way and that way because it was badly collected and I could do that. And whenever he's asked point blank, do you think he did it, he says, well, you know, it's not my point to say who did it, it's just the American justice, you know. They're very funny. Whereas of course poor Robert Kardashian then died of cancer. Cochran and Shapiro don't feature in these things. I think Robert Shapiro immediately after the trial kind of turned on the Dream Team and said, you know, we played the race card from the bottom of the pack. So yeah, that's the Dream Team. Very, very colorful bunch of people.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, again, just showing what a moment this was in culture in that time period, how it couldn't just be anyone involved in the trial, anyone involved in the defense and prosecution. It reminds me a little bit of the Trump presidential campaign and current administration, where it's just all these characters, all these personalities who just swarms together, and they're just, and it seems like they're defining trait is not so much that they're competent or anything. It's just that they I guess, for lack of a better word, want to be famous, want power. Yeah, they're showmen.
I mean, Johnny Cochran was not a great forensic lawyer in the way that Barry Sheck was, but he came up with slogans. If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Yeah.
That's a great slogan. He understood his audience. He was on TV shows. He was on Howard Stern. He was winning the court of public opinion. I mean, sadly, what I think is really sad is he died in 2005, so he doesn't appear in any of the recent, more context-filled documentaries. But he was a showman, and ironically, he was also done for spousal abuse and was a bigamist, I believe, at one point. Or had, if not married, then was running two families. So he was a very interesting character.
These people were all characters.
Yeah.
Like, they were basically written into life, if you will.
And even Alan Dershowitz, right? I mean, like, if you can't get a more sort of charismatic but media savvy, like looking for a quote, kind of a legal mind, right? I mean, I don't know. Yeah.
So, it was a mess from beginning to end. It was this moment in time when all these forces just coalesced and to create this a circus, for lack of a better word. And I feel like the victims, I do remember at the time, Ron Goldman's dad, who to this day is a very strong victims advocate. He was there really trying to remind people of why they were all there. Why, you know, and it was because of this horrific murder.
Yeah, I think Fred Goldman is so, I always remember him. And I always remember the sister, Kim Goldman, every day at the trial and then crying when the verdict came in on her father's shoulder. Mm. And you just think that the lives that have been ruined by this are immense. So while we're on the lawyers, is it worth saying a word about Judge Lance Ito? Because you said it was a circus, but isn't the point of the judge that he prevents the circus from coming to town?
Yeah, because he was like, yeah, cameras. Yeah, that's fine. And I mean, his behavior was just so dodgy. And just, I mean, he's still alive, right? I mean, it's interesting that enough time has elapsed that I do have to check these things. Lance Ito, Japanese American. Just so California. It's a very diverse crew. You got a little bit of everything going on.
Yeah,
you know?
No, he retired in 2015, kept a low profile since the trial. He's another one, along with Chris Darden. He's not written a book about it or sort of spoken publicly about it. But, you know, he was on the phone to Graydon Carter, Vanity Fair, during the trial. I mean, he definitely...
Oh, for God's sake.
He loved the publicity, and I think... I mean, to a certain extent, it would take a stronger man than many to control a circus like that. I'm not sure any judge would have succeeded fully, but he definitely was not the guy he was tried and found wanting, I think we can all agree. I think it was... To me, the whole thing was ridiculous.
Well, I mean, what was it? You're going to have to remind me. What was it that he really did or did? I mean, I remember that it was this big deal that he was going to allow cameras in the courtroom. But, I mean, also people were basically just alleging at that time that he just was not running things appropriately. Is that a correct assessment?
Yeah, I think when Johnny Cochran was grandstanding, he wouldn't sort of keep him, you know, to task and tell him to stop swerving away and grandstanding and actually just ask a question. I think there were questions about, I mean, one of the most crucial turning points in the case. Well, I mean, this is how I think about it, right? There was just overwhelming DNA evidence that OJ did it. It was all circumstantial evidence. DNA at the time was incredibly new as a technology.
Yes, it was.
And the person explaining it to the crew was very boring and just bored. I think there was like a month of DNA explanation. It was just like the jury was just sick and tired of it. But I think that nonetheless, the DNA evidence might have been convincing. I think maybe not in the way it was presenting, but it might have been. But then you cast a doubt on the chain of evidence and the custody of that evidence. And the way you do that is by portraying the LAPD as institutionally racist. And the way you do that is by focusing on Mark Furman. And the way you destroy him is by finding some tapes that a TV screenplay writer had made of him, her interviewing him, getting background where he's boasting about how he beats up black people and calls them nigger and blah, blah, blah. And one of the biggest thing was whether Judge Lance Ito was going to let those tapes be played as relevant to the case.
Right.
And obviously he
did. It was like anything that could have come out did come out. It was, here's the funny thing is that, you know, could the police have been corrupt? Obviously, yes. But could also everything, you know, like independent of all of these other factors, police corruption, racism, it's still possible that he just could have murdered these people.
That's my point. I mean, I believe that the LAPD is institutionally racist. If anyone wants to really get into the LAPD history, there's a podcast amazing called The Dollop. They did a 3-part series on the LAPD.
Yes, I haven't listened to that.
So good.
I mean, again, as you already mentioned, this happened a couple years after the Rodney King trial and the subsequent LA riots. So, I mean, it was a pretty racially charged moment.
It couldn't have been a worse time. It couldn't have been more mishandled. And you've got to feel for Marsha Clark as she's under scrutiny. Her one key guy is Mark Furman, and that guy is going to get destroyed because as soon as that black jury hears a tape of him referring to black people as niggers that he beats up, it's game over, right? I mean, you may as well end the trial at that point.
Right. I mean, we should talk about the jury as well. I remember it was this whole, where are we going to hold the case? How are we going to find impartial jury members? Because again, I just really want to reiterate, imagine your favorite celebrity in the year 2017 having their, you know, ex-spouse and another person murdered in this way, and then them being brought in. Just try to imagine. I don't know. Who do we have? Okay, imagine if Dwayne The Rock Johnson were accused of something like this. He's pretty beloved, right?
Yeah, but the problem is that even then, even though it was held downtown in LA, which is going to be a more ethnic minority jury, even then, Marsha Clark sort of still, like, she didn't object. She accepted some jurors that she could have vetoed, specifically black women, because she thought she had a connection to black women because she had prosecuted so many spousal abuse cases, and she thought that black women would hate OJ because he married a white woman. And neither of those were true. So she fundamentally did not take the advice of focus groups and that were critical to her views. Like, she had definite sort of evidence confirmation bias. So partly she got the jury that she didn't vet properly. But secondly, when the verdict is returned, one of the guys gives like a black power salute. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? So evidently the jury wasn't vetted properly.
Right. And well, people put onto this was a situation where you could project whatever you wanted. That's I think a real key thing is it was like watching a play or watching a TV show play out, or like a serialized drama, and where you could just like sit over dinner or, you know, the water cooler at work and really nitpick down and really talk about these people, these characters. You know, like the way my mom and I discuss the series Poldark now, you know, well, you know, Elizabeth this and blah, 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 that, and, you know, well, Ross can do no wrong.
And this is, I think, what made ultimately Fred Goldman so angry, because he could see that in the midst of the circus and everyone becoming cartoon characters, the real and tragic death of his son was being totally overlooked. And that's why to this day, I think he's incredibly angry. Before we get into the jury, because I want to get more into the jury, let's talk a little bit just to round out the trial, unless you have other things about the trial you want to talk about. Just the whole Chris Darden making OJ try on the glove thing. So if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. This is a blood-soaked glove. It had dried up in evidence. OJ just stopped taking his arthritis meds, which meant that his hands swelled up. And you know that if you contract your hand, you've got like a sort of plastic or whatever, that disgusting thing, you know, those gloves that you wear before you have to touch evidence. That glove was never going to cut. It was never going to fit his hand if you didn't want to.
Exactly.
Chris Darden, you got punked. You got played. You got played. And yeah, I think that's like why he's never given evidence. He's never done interviews. He's never written a book, because he just retired into academic life, actually. He became a law professor, I think, at UCLA. Because I think he knows it. And I think he feels shame for that.
I remember that moment in the trial. And again, there were so many moments in the trial that really stand out. The glove, and when, you know, Cato took the stand, and these sort of episodic moments that you could really latch on to.
Oh, fucking hell, Cato, okay, then talk about comedy relief.
Yeah, but I mean, I remember the glove thing, and it's just like, it's dried up from the blood. He's putting it on over, you know, gloves, evidence gloves. Of course, it's not going to fit. Anyone who's ever owned winter gloves made of leather, and you ever get them really, really wet, you know about the shrinkage. You know what happens. So it just felt so stupid seeing people just be like, oh, the gloves don't fit. But they capitalized on that moment. I mean, that's their job, you know, because you know, there is a certain amount of showmanship that goes into trial, as a trial lawyer. That's just how it works. And, but like the people involved, they took it to the nth degree and helped just sort of continue to create that insane cultural moment. Like at no point, it feels like, did anyone ever step back and be like, what are we doing? Except for a poor Fred Goldman. Mm-hmm. But it just was this whirlwind that just kept going and going and going. Almost of its, like it took on a life of its own.
Absolutely. It had an energy of its own, didn't it? I've often thought, and I think this is kind of fascinating, right? Like I've been called, have you ever done jury duty?
I have. I never got to the point where I was called into the courtroom because the case, it was not a very sexy case to begin with. Apparently it was something having to do with damages related to some kind of like construction material or something that had caused illness. And they reached a deal during that day of jury selection. But so I never got to that point of sitting there and being questioned and all that.
Hmm. Yeah. So I've gotten out of it. I think I was called when I was doing my university finals and so got out of it. I just think how amazing it would have been to be called up for jury duty, find you're on the trial of the century, months in a hotel room, no TV, no magazines, with people you may or may not like, on guard duty. Like people always criticize the jury, how could they return that verdict? But the more, and that was kind of my reaction as a teenager, but the more and more I get into it, I think, A, the prosecution case was not presented well.
Mm-hmm.
B, and everyone says like, how could they return the verdict that quickly, like within hours? And Fred Goldman has said like, how could they listen to all that evidence and return it with hours? They just wanted to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's admirable, and maybe that's a dereliction of duty. But after months and months and months and going absolutely stir crazy, I kind of get it that they were kind of group mentally traumatized is too strong, but I think there's a kind of like, I think they were banging up against the walls to get out of there. I mean, so many had dropped out, they were down to very few alternates left. I mean, this was not the mm-hmm. same jury at the end that started. I think they just wanted to get the hell out of there. That's my theory.
Well, there was the incident where things had been going on for a while, and the jury wanted to like meet with Judge Ito and just basically be like, what the fuck, dude? And he refused, and like they did this mini protest when they came in, like everyone was wearing black or something. So yeah, the jury was definitely under a lot of stress. And I mean, have any of those jury members ever written a book or done interviews? I'm sure they have.
I think a lot of them. And there's a couple who appear in AJ Made in America. And it's kind of interesting because I think that they feel, or at least the ones that appear in the documentaries, feel that they were accused immediately after the verdict of being racist, so they were going to fine for mm-hmm. OJ regardless, or what I'm saying, dereliction of duty, they just wanted to go home. And I think there's something mm-hmm. for some of them, there will be some of that, but there's one lady who appears in a lot, she does a lot of TV, and she's very straightforward, very articulate, and she will go through things like Mark Furman, and she'll go through things like the putting on the glove, and she'll tell you exactly why the prosecution's case wasn't good. And there were sloppy techniques. You know, I think OJ did it, and his blood was found on the Bronco and whatever for the correct reasons, but you don't collect the evidence, leave it in your car overnight before taking it into the station. I mean, the chain of evidence was really compromised, and she talks about that. But she does also honestly talk about the fact that they just wanted to go home. They didn't need to deliberate for hours and hours and hours. But she's very, very articulate. And I've actually come to have a kind of 180 degree view and actually a certain respect for the OJ jury that I think he did it, but I don't think it was proven.
Yeah, no, I guess it's more recent is the Casey Anthony trial, where they simply didn't make their case. And
yeah.
And she was allowed to walk. And it's like, I'm sorry, but you know, if you can't, if you know, I think it was a case where the evidence was just so, the physical evidence was just not there to the extent that it needed to be. What else do you want to discuss?
I think that's pretty much it. I mean, maybe, I don't know.
Well, how about the life of OJ afterwards? So he was later found liable because, I mean, in America, we have something called double jeopardy. You cannot be, unless, you know, there's a hung jury or mistrial, you can't be retried for the same crime. But they went after a civil suit, the Goldman family, for which he was found responsible for the deaths. And apparently OJ has never paid a cent of the judgment that was made against him. Yeah.
I mean, to me, the later life of AJ is just one of farce. I mean, this is a guy who was bankrupted. He couldn't sell his stories. I think some of his lawyers are still owed money. He ends up nicking merchandise that was his in the first place from a hotel room. I mean, it's just so pathetic, yes, and laughable. And he's out of prison now. And what is he going to do?
Well, he's his eldest daughter from his first marriage has always been on his side, always. And I believe he is now living with her in Florida now that he's out again.
Huh.
So, and he was seen this past Halloween 2017, handing out candy to kids wearing, I don't know if it's, it looked a little bit too new to be, you know, it's probably a replica of his old Buffalo Bills jersey.
Trying to regain some of his early glory?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just sort of like, you know, with some celebrities, they get to a point where they're basically a character of themselves. And I mean, what happened, yeah, his life just became very sordid afterwards. It was essentially ruined. His kids with Nicole, I think, were taken by Nicole's old sister, maybe. But, like, I don't think they have anything to do with him, really. It's only this one older daughter who's really stood by him.
That's so tragic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we can wrap it up there, right? I mean, I think we've gone into why we think what we think.
Truly an American tragedy and a trial of the century for sure. And I think it's worth going over for a number of reasons that we have mentioned here.
Mm.
There you go.
It's just so sad. I mean, I think it's, I don't know. It's the death of a young, beautiful woman, of a young man who had no reason to be anywhere near this appalling and violent marriage, and kids who now have no mother, and a life that went from being beloved and mainstream success into penury and vilification. A jury that was, you know, probably still is in certain circles vilified, and yet probably had something about them in what they did. Lawyers' lives, Chris Darden, a black man who was prosecuting OJ, went against his community and was vilified, has never spoken about what happened since publicly. I mean, so many peripheral lives have been damaged by this, and the course of the lives have been turned. Obviously, none as much as Nicole Brown Simpson and poor Ron Goldman, but it is an emblematic thing. I think so many of the issues that it encapsulates about celebrity, about whether women are believed and taken seriously and protected when they feel under threat, these are very valid concerns today and are played out with these poor rape victims and sexual harassment victims that are coming out against powerful men who have been protected. Everybody knew, but nobody did anything. That sounds familiar, right?
It sure does.
So that to me is the tragedy of this case. Like, there's so many tragedies in this case. One of the big tragedies is this happened in the mid-90s and we're now in the mid-10s. And still, everybody knows. Nobody does anything. Nobody protects.
Well, it's nobody else's business. So, you know, I mean, like, there's that sort of attitude of it's not my business, and I'm not going to stick my nose in it.
Mm. Okay.
I mean, it's a very American thing that happened. It's just so emblematic of the moment, of the time. And it's part of the reasons why we have the Kardashians. So let's not forget that.
Oh, God. Absolutely. But it does show you, doesn't it? It shows you the dark heart underneath celebrity and fame. And I think it kind of links into what we've done with the Dahlia, these glittery lives and the tragedy underneath them. But yeah, thank you very much for going through this with me. I know it's
no problem. This was fun. This was sort of a spontaneous thing that I woke up this morning to see your messages. I was like, oh, let's do this today. Let's knock this one out.
I know. I just feel I've been lingering over this for a while. If anyone wants to get into this, I would strongly recommend the Oscar-winning documentary, OJ Made in America. It's a four-part, each 2 hours, ESPN documentary, really about the state of race and sports and power in America. A savage indictment of the system, but really fascinating. I would strongly recommend the miniseries People versus OJ Simpson. If you want to hear the tragic letters that Nicole Simpson wrote to OJ Simpson detailing the abuse and her guilt, her astonishing, really. But listen to those Real Crime podcast episodes on the OJ trial. They're really fascinating. And just be a little exercise caution and self-care when Googling for the crime scene images, because they're really savage. And also check out the Dominic Dunn Vanity Fair archives. Yeah. And other than that, thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Julia, for joining me.
Yes, you're very welcome. Thank you for suggesting this topic.
No problem. And if you want to get involved in Vassals of Kingsgrave, you can Google Vassals of Kingsgrave or VOK podcast, find our WordPress, Twitter, Facebook pages. And if you want to get onto the forums, look for the forums of A Podcast of Ice and Fire. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.